Today's message is going to be on Genesis chapter 32 through chapter 33. That's two whole chapters, so there's a lot of material here. I'll jump right into it. You can read the passage on your own if you would like. I'm not going to read it, so pause now and you can read it. Last week, we discussed Jacob and his flight from Laban. And this week, he jumps out of that frying pan and into the fire. He had gone to stay with Laban for 20 years in order to hide from his older brother Esau, who had intended to kill him. And now, Jacob is returning to his homeland and must confront Esau. Before he gets to Esau, however, he will have an interesting encounter with a mysterious stranger. So then, jumping into the passage. In verses 1 and 2, we have a little anecdote about the naming of the place where Jacob is. Verse 1 tells us that angels met Jacob on his way, and what these messengers of God may have told Jacob is unclear, but he certainly recognized them to be messengers from God. Evidently, because of his having met them there, Jacob named the place Mahanaim, meaning two camps. This, we suppose, from the context of verse 1, is because both his camp and the camp of God's angels are in the same place. However, we will see that there are perhaps other reasons in the text that he might name the place as he did. The place Mahanaim, incidentally, appears throughout the Old Testament narratives, but never again has any major significance. In any case, we get into the main portion of the narrative at verse 3, in which Jacob, in returning to the Promised Land, has a problem. Esau will know that Jacob has come to the Promised Land, and Esau, when we left him, was planning to kill Jacob. Now, Esau himself is not in the Promised Land. Esau is in Seir, in the country of Edom, which we discussed previously in a sermon about Esau and Edom on October the 23rd, 2016. So if you want to look that sermon up, get a little more information on Edom, that's October 23rd, 2016. Now, Jacob could simply bypass Esau without Esau's knowledge. Okay, Esau is about 120 miles south of Jacob's location, but that could lead to trouble down the road when Esau finds out that Jacob is in the Promised Land. He could strike suddenly. Jacob, since he's on the move at the moment, is a little more mobile and perhaps better off. So, Jacob sends Esau messengers, and Jacob's message to Esau strikes a very conciliatory tone. He calls himself Esau's servant and calls Esau his master. And he says that he is seeking to find favor in Esau's sight. Now, in verse 6, Jacob gets a response to this message, and it is a response which reasonably frightens him. The response is that Esau is coming and is bringing along 400 men. Now, we don't know how many people are with Jacob, but we can guess that it isn't 400 people. It's certainly not 400 fighting men. So then, in verses 7 and 8, Jacob responds, as we might expect, with some panic. Jacob is so afraid of Esau that he splits his group into two camps, so that if they are attacked, one camp can escape while the other one fights. Now, this, of course, is another good reason to call the place Mahanaim. So then, having been faced with Esau, Jacob's response, after taking some defensive measures, is to pray, and that, of course, is a good response. We see his prayer in verses 9 through 12. And in his prayer, he calls on God by God's name, and he also calls on him by his familial relationship, that being God's relationship to his fathers, Abraham and Isaac. And he also calls on God as the God who promised to return him to the Promised Land. He notes in his prayer that he doesn't deserve any of God's favor and is thankful that God has given him so much. And he further asks God to protect him from Esau. And I think his reasoning in asking God to protect him from Esau is very interesting. He asks that God protect him because of God's own faithfulness. He is calling on God to fulfill God's promise to make Jacob's descendants like the sand of the sea. So then, since he has promised this, Jacob hopes that God will spare his life, though I suppose that God would not be bound to do so on those grounds, seeing that Jacob already has 12 children at least. However, we might expect that God will save him simply because God said that he would bring Jacob back to the land, which Jacob has also noted. So then, Jacob is praying for God to do good to Jacob, not because Jacob deserves good, but because God is good, and because God has made a promise, and Jacob expects that God will keep his promise. Having prayed and made his defensive measures, Jacob now starts to give gifts to Esau in order to appease him. We see this in verses 13 through 21, wherein Jacob attempts to bribe Esau by sending him much livestock. Jacob sends to Esau 9 droves of livestock, including goats, camels, donkeys, sheep, etc. Now, by my back-of-the-envelope calculation, I'm no expert in livestock, I will readily admit, and of course, the value of the livestock could vary considerably based on its quality and so forth. But Jacob sent to Esau some $234,000 worth of livestock, and that's not even including camel calves. He staggered the arrival of these droves of livestock to increase the potency of the bribe. If Esau received everything at once, it's a big deal, but the shock is quickly over. With the livestock staggered, Esau is hit with wave after wave of gifts. Always the smart salesman, Jacob hits Esau with the old, "But wait, there's more!" He's begging Esau for acceptance, and if Esau accepts Jacob, he gets sheep. But wait, he also gets camels. But wait, he also gets, and you get the point. So then, having discussed Jacob and the measures he took to stop Esau from giving him any trouble, we come to the section of the passage in which Jacob meets a stranger. This is going to be from verse 22 of chapter 32 through the end of the passage. Now, in this passage, the first thing we see in verse 22 through 24 is another defensive measure which Jacob takes, in which he sends everyone else across the river and remains on the north side alone. Now, perhaps he's doing this because he expects that Esau will come in the night, and so he is protecting himself by staying away from the rest of the camp. Of course, this could also be a protection for the rest of the camp. If Esau comes and he's only looking for Jacob, then perhaps he would spare everyone else. So everyone has crossed the Jabbok River, except for Jacob, who is staying behind. When abruptly, in verse 24, a man appears. A mysterious man. Who is this man? Where did he come from? The man appears, and he wrestles with Jacob until morning. Now, incidentally, anyone who has ever wrestled competitively can tell you that 6 minutes on the wrestling mat is enough to expend all the energy you've got, so wrestling all night must have been downright exhausting. So who is this mysterious person? Well, believe it or not, this mysterious wrestler is God incarnate. You don't expect that when you pull away the Lucha Libre mask, but that's what you get. So there are plenty of proofs of this. In verse 28, the mystery wrestler states that Jacob has struggled with God, evidently referring to himself in this wrestling match struggle. He also calls Jacob Israel, meaning he struggles with God. So two references right there that the mystery wrestler makes to being God. Of course, the simple fact that he thinks he can change Jacob's name to Israel also indicates that he is God. The wrestler also behaves similarly to the angel of the Lord. In Judges chapter 13, the angel of the Lord refuses to give his name, and so does the mysterious wrestler. Not only this, but the wrestler injures Jacob in an apparently miraculous way, a very godlike thing for him to do. Not only does he say that he's God and act like he's God, we also have another incident in Genesis 35:10 in which God himself clarifies that Jacob is, in fact, to be called Israel, indicating that God and the wrestler are in agreement. Not only that, but Jacob recognizes the person to be God. Jacob comes away from the encounter saying, "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." I believe that Jacob's life was delivered because he was dealing with the second person of the Trinity. He can look on the face of the pre-incarnate Christ, but could not look on the face of the Father. That's a topic that we dealt with in the Sermon on the Angel of the Lord, which was published in July 17th of 2016, if you want to go back and look that up. Jacob also calls the place Peniel, meaning the face of God. So then the mysterious wrestler calls himself God, acts like God, receives confirmation of his actions from God, and is recognized by Jacob as being God. So if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. Of course, we also get explicit confirmation from the scriptures of the fact that the mysterious wrestler is God. We see this in Hosea chapter 12, verse 3, which says that Jacob, quote, strove with God. This leads us inevitably to ask, why would God appear in the flesh and wrestle with Jacob all night? To which I must say, your guess is as good as mine. Ultimately, we can only speculate as to God's motivations. I suppose that, if nothing else, it's a demonstration to us that God can come in the flesh and is a prefiguring of Christ coming. But there are other reasons that he might have come. Perhaps Jacob's hesitancy to cross the Jabbok is an indicator that Jacob is planning to flee from Esau and not return to the Promised Land, which God himself had declared that Jacob would do. So if Jacob was ready to flee, then God was prepared to come down there and wrestle him to the point that he couldn't keep running. And in fact, the injury that he gives him will stop him from doing so. I wonder if some of those listening are in a similar circumstance to that which we might presume Jacob is in, refusing to do that which God would have us to do, such that we are suffering for it. We're always better off to do what God says the first time than we are to wait until he makes us do it and we have suffered for it. Perhaps Jacob's life of wealth gained by deception has led him to live in pride, and God intends to humble him by injuring him in this wrestling match. Of course, it could be that the wrestling match is intended to foreshadow the nature of Jacob's descendants, chosen as God's people, but always wrestling him and refusing to submit. Whatever the case, God showed up for a wrestling match. So then, concerning the match itself. First, let's note an interesting bit of wordplay. Jacob is wrestling at the Jabbok, and in the Hebrew, Jacob is Jacob, Jabbok is Yabbok, and wrestled is Abake. So, Jacob, Abake, Yabbok. It is a little bit of a wordplay there that is of note. In the match, Jacob is coming out on top. Now, why is God letting him win? Beats me. I don't know. God is letting Jacob win, however. And seeing that he is losing, God stops going easy on Jacob and injures his hip. Touches his hip. If you want to take the ESV for it, he dislocates his hip. The exact part and the exact injury is not entirely clear. The Bible, incidentally, is not a medical text. But it is some part of the hip, thigh, buttock area he has injured. Regardless of what the injury is, the injury will leave Jacob with a permanent limp. And though no mention is made of it elsewhere in scriptures, Jacob's injury spurs a tradition in Israel not to eat the meat of that part of an animal, which corresponds to the same part on Jacob. So they don't eat this sinew of the thigh or whatever the exact part is. Anyway, back to the match. Jacob grabs hold of God and refuses to let him go until God blesses him. God does, in fact, bless him. We don't get the text of the blessing. But before God will bless him, he gives Jacob the name Israel, which means he struggles with God, as we have mentioned. And like the angel of the Lord in Judges, he refuses to give his own name. So then, the match ends with God blessing Jacob. Jacob lets God go, and God leaves. Jacob then names the place Peniel, because he saw God's face and lived. Peniel means the face of God. We know, of course, that one cannot see the face of the Father and live. We get that from Exodus chapter 33, verse 23. But the face of the Son many people have seen, as we have already mentioned. So then, upon limping out of his tent, Jacob sees that Esau is coming, and we get back to the bulk of the story. When Esau appears with his 400 men, I suppose that Jacob sees them coming on the horizon, and he goes on ahead of the women and children. He divides them into groups behind him based on their maternity, with the least valuable groups going first, and the most valuable group, that being Rachel and Joseph, coming last. If there is a battle, then we can expect that the ones in the back have the best chance of escaping. So Jacob is essentially sacrificing himself and putting a special care towards saving his favorites, that being Rachel and Joseph. So Jacob comes to Esau bowing down, and his wives and children, as they come, do likewise. Jacob bows 7 times. This, evidently, is a sign of total submission, or at least so says the NIV Study Bible, which reads, "Bowing 7 times is, quote, a sign of total submission, documented also in texts found at Tel El Amarna in Egypt and dating to the 14th century B.C. I have a link which will appear in the library that will give you a little more information about those tablets. I don't have exact translations of those. If someone has some exact translations of those that they would like to give me, I will gladly link those as well. But in the end, Esau, when he arrives, is not mad at all. He's glad to see Jacob. He hugs and kisses him and weeps for joy. Now, we've had all this buildup for 2 chapters. To Esau's arrival, expecting that Esau is going to kill Jacob, and we get exactly the opposite from him. 20 years have been plenty of time for Esau to forget his lost blessing, and so Esau has also become very wealthy, and based on the size of his entourage, he's evidently wealthier than Jacob. He's over the blessing. He's not worried about the inheritance. He's not worried about the birthright anymore. In fact, Esau is so wealthy that he at first refuses to accept Jacob's gift. Now, you would have to be pretty wealthy to give up $200,000 or more worth of gifts. And he only accepts the gift after Jacob begs him to take it. So Esau has done well for himself. He's happy. He hasn't just changed his mind because all these droves of livestock have come. He's coming out with all of his men so that he can evidently throw a party for Jacob. He's so glad to see him. And it's funny that Jacob sees things a little differently, and he decides to deceive Esau again. I've noted many times that Jacob is really not the better of the two sons, and we have yet another example of it here. You see, in verse 12, Esau beckons Jacob to come with him to Seir, urging him that they should travel together. Now, the ESV has him saying, "I will go ahead of you," but the footnotes acknowledge that the preposition in question could mean, "I will go along with you." The context of Jacob's refusal, however, makes it clear that Esau intended for the two to ride together. Jacob's response is that his family and livestock are too frail to keep up with Esau, and so Esau should go along ahead while Jacob follows more slowly behind. Jacob assures Esau, however, in verse 14, that he will meet up with him in Seir. In verse 15, Esau, wanting to help Jacob with his supposedly slow and weak livestock, urges him, "Let me leave you some of the people who are with me." Esau really wants to help Jacob out. He's demonstrating true repentance for his prior angry attitude. He isn't trying to trick Jacob so that he can hurt him. There's no need for him to do that. If Esau wanted to hurt Jacob, he could have already killed him and taken everything. Instead, Esau has offered to give Jacob all of his possessions back, and now he's offering him shelter in Seir and men to help him on his journey. He's giving him anything that you could expect Esau to give. Jacob, of course, refuses this, saying that he doesn't need the assistance. Suddenly, when Esau has men to stick around, the livestock that Jacob had said were weak and frail aren't so weak and frail after all. He's really wriggling out here. And we see the reason for Jacob's deception in verses 16 through 17. While Esau goes home to Seir, Jacob sneaks away to Sukkoth. So the point is this: Esau is repentant, and Jacob is not. Jacob has shown Esau kindness out of fear, and he has bowed down to the ground and played friendly only because it is a show. Jacob is lying to Esau to save his own skin, and Jacob, true to form, is still a liar. His actions betray that he isn't sorry for pulling the rug out from under his brother. Esau, on the other hand, demonstrates real repentance for his past hatred of Jacob, and he does everything in his power to help his lying brother. So who's the better son? This is the last narrative we'll see of Esau, and he's had his failures. He married the wrong women. He was angry enough to kill his brother. He was foolish enough to sell his birthright for a bowl of soup. But in the end, Esau is penitent and forgiving. Jacob, on the other hand, keeps on failing and never changes. He's taken advantage of his brother, who may well have starved. He's stolen his brother's blessing by deceiving his father. He has behaved like a fool in choosing a poor bride. He shows divisive favoritism toward his wives and his children. He deceived Laban. He displays a general faithlessness toward God, such that he has to even be wrestled with. And now he continues to deceive his brother, who is offering him nothing but help and friendship. Now, of course, Jacob wasn't supposed to go back to Seir. He was supposed to go back to his own promised land, but he could have told Esau that. Instead, he's deceiving him. So I have to ask, why did God choose Jacob as the son of the promise over Esau? And the answer is that God chooses whom he will choose, and he does so according to his own design. Perhaps he showed Jacob mercy, if for no other reason than to demonstrate to us that we cannot earn mercy by our works. Esau doesn't earn mercy by his works, and Jacob earns mercy in spite of his works. I must say, though, I believe that Esau, even though he was not the chosen son of the promise, ultimately found favor with God. Clearly, God has blessed Esau just as he blessed Ishmael before him, and Esau is vastly wealthier than Jacob at this point. He can muster hundreds of men at a moment's notice. He has so much wealth that he can turn down all that Jacob offered him. So clearly, God has done something good for Esau, and evidently he's done a work in his heart such that Esau can show a great deal of grace. But in any case, for now and forevermore, he leaves the story, and Jacob moves on to the promised land. So Israel, that is his new name, travels back to Canaan, where he buys a plot of land in Shechem and pitches his tent. Now, the fact that he purchased this land is noted in verse 19 with a specific sum that was paid. This is another of Genesis' legal claims to the promised land for the people of Israel. Remember, the original audience reading this book or hearing it read was preparing to conquer the promised land, and having a legal claim to a piece of the land gives them a justification for doing so. And Jacob, perhaps now more than ever, is seen devoting himself to God in that he names the place where he settles El Elohe Israel, which means God is the God of Israel. So then to conclude, finally, Jacob has arrived at the promised land and has shaken the fear of Esau that has burdened him for 20 years. He is finally a free man, living on great wealth, and settled in the promised land with a multitude of descendants. God's promises at Bethel all those years ago are being fulfilled. And so moving forward, Jacob will remain in the narrative for the rest of the book of Genesis, but from here on, the emphasis will shift away from him and onto his children, whom we will talk about next week.
For those of you who might be listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.